From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I was in a neighbor's garden the other day where their cherished hollyhocks were in bloom, and I thought, how can I never have written about them or talked about them on the show? They looked dreamy. And then later that same day, I happened to see some serious flower porn on Facebook featuring, you guessed it, hollyhocks, with the pornographer being none other than today's guest, Joseph Tokanovich, author of Plant Breeding for the Home Gardener and Rock Gardening, Reimagining a Classic Style. A true plant nerd with a special love for old-fashioned things like hollyhocks. And he's here to entice us all to grow them and clue us into which ones he recommends most of all. And as I scrolled through his Facebook page looking at more and more hollyhocks, I also saw that we were both nuts enough to share a fascination with recent headlines in the nursery industry trade press about GMO petunias. So we're going to fill you in on that, too. So welcome back to the show, Joseph. How are you?
I am great. It's great to be here.
Now, actually, you say great, and I should really thank you for even taking the time right now, because I know you're, so, shall we say, a little bit distracted? Are you a little distracted?
Yes, I'm standing next to piles of boxes because we're moving in a couple weeks, but always happy to talk about hollyhocks.
And when a gardener moves, that's a big deal because it's not just the usual. It's woo.
Yeah. More plants than anything is moving. But
oh, my goodness. And you're going from the Midwest. You're going to Virginia?
Yes, so Williamsburg, Virginia.
And you're going to explore a whole different zone and plant hardiness possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. Go from zone 5 to zone 7. So it's. I'm already starting a list of all the things that I couldn't grow before that I'll be able to grow now.
Uh-oh. Will that include hollyhocks?
Well, hollyhocks are pretty much, I mean, very adaptable. So
okay. That's
definitely something I can grow both places. So that's a check mark in their favor, I guess.
One of the times that we spoke previously on the show, you know, we talked about your passion for gladiolas, however we want to say it. And, you know, I think of that as sort of an old-fashioned favorite, too, maybe of a slightly different vintage. But hollyhocks, you know I don't grow them anymore. I lust after them, as I said in the intro, every time I see them in someone's garden. But, you know, I was thinking, are they even in the garden centers? Like, where are they? When do they sell them? What do they look like when they sell them? And I guess that's probably one of the reasons they're not sort of pushed more and more ubiquitous, right?
So there's something that you're really going to have to usually grow from seed, because they're difficult plants to handle at a nursery, because they're partly because they're just so massive. You know, they can be 6-8 feet tall, and that's awkward to deal with in a little nursery pot. They fall over. They're hard to ship. So you're rarely going to see them grown as plants for sale at a nursery.
And the ones that are sort of the traditional ones is the genus and species, the species that's the most traditional one. I think in the book you call it the poster child of the genus. Is it Rosea alcea?
I think Rosea. That's how I say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the classic hollyhock, and that's the biennial one. So it's going to be
right. Leaves
the first year, and then flowers the second year, and then that's it, which also a lot of people shy away from biennials. But there's lots of great perennial species as well that can be grown.
Okay. So with that one, I mean, you know, it's really a shame that people shy away from biennials. And when I buy biennials, I'd rather buy them before they put their spike up or whatever. You know, I'd rather buy them in their early time and get them settled in my garden before they're ready to flower. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't mind getting them young.
The right time to buy them would be the first year when they're just in leaf, but that's right. Also a hard sell. A lot of people don't want to buy a plant that's just leaves. They want to buy pretty flowers.
Right, so it's either too tall, can't even fit in my car if I bought it at the garden center, if they could even make it work in a 2-gallon pot, like you said, 6 feet tall, that's a mess. And on the other hand, the other time to buy it, maybe even the better time, it doesn't look like much except a rosette of leaves or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a great garden plant and a terrible plant for a nursery, unfortunately.
So we can grow them from seed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You said there's other species, so what other ones are there?
One that you're going to find most often is the fig-leaved hollyhock, which is Fissifolia.
Oh.
And that's a good perennial species.
Okay. Fissifolia fig leafed,
Fissifolia, the fig leaf hollyhock, yeah. And it's a really beautiful one, single flowers, a little, which is the other great bane of hollyhocks, the rust fungus on the leaves. And that one you're going to find readily available, and that's a good perennial one to start with.
Okay. And so that's a perennial. And
that's a perennial. And you might also look for, there's a series called the Spotlight series, which is new hybrid breeding that are really great perennials, have a great wide color range. They're supposed to be really disease resistant too, though honestly I've seen rust on them in my garden as well. But the Spotlight series is a really good, another perennial series of hybrids.
I think it was on Facebook I saw one that I didn't recognize, and you said, I think in the caption, my favorite hollyhock. Do we say Alcia? How do we say it, the genus? And then Hohenacra.
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those species that I have written a lot, but I rarely say out loud. So, yeah, something like that.
Okay.
It's a really beautiful perennial, and I've been really impressed with it. It's been long-lived for me. The least rust, least disease on the leaves of any that I've grown. And it has a really beautiful, almost silvery, fuzzy foliage, which is really nice, and pale yellow flowers.
Yeah, the flowers were a beautiful pale yellow, and with that silver foliage, it was very appealing. Like I said earlier in the intro, flower porn, that was one of the pictures that really got me.
Yeah, and it's such a great plant because it's so easy. I mean, I've had it for years, and it's like in dry, sandy soil, and I never do anything with it, and it's just tough and blooms each year, and it's really been a standout for me in the genus.
Okay. And so with something like that, did you grow that from seed, or where did you find that one?
I grew that from seed, yeah. And there's a few sources that carry it. But, yeah, really, you're going to almost certainly have to do almost any of them from seed. Mm-hmm. But luckily, they're really easy from seed. They have big, fat seeds that germinate, no fuss, and make big, vigorous seedlings. So they're really easy to do from seed.
Okay. When would I start them, or does it depend whether it's the biennials or the perennials or what? Like, how far in advance am I doing what?
So to get blooms, actually, right now is a good time to start either biennials or perennials. If you start them in the summer, they'll have enough time to get leaves up this year, to bulk up, and then flower for you next year. So
okay.
I often start them later just because in spring I'm so busy with so much else.
Right.
And then once summer calms down, I can sow out my hollyhock seeds, and then there'll be leaves this year, and then whether perennial or biennial start flowering for me in the second year.
The rust thing, this is a fungal situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so tell people who might not know, like, what's the deal? Because this was, of course, the real drawback, like where I had them years and years and years ago, you know, the classic cottage garden kind of, you know, edge of the garden kind of flower backdrop thing. But, you know, they defoliate or they get real nasty, the foliage. So tell us a little bit more about the rust, because that was what sort of undid it for me, and I didn't know to try other kinds at that time.
Yeah, so rust is a fungal disease, and it makes these little orange bumps that looks a lot like rust. So, it, you know, visually, that's where the name comes from. And like you said, it can be pretty ugly, and it can really defoliate them. And the classic ones, Rosea is probably the most susceptible, and it can be pretty gnarly with the rust.
Right.
Some of the other species are more resistant. I've yet to grow one that's immune.
Okay.
Everything I grow gets at least a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But there's two things you can do. One is plant them in the back of the border with something else in front.
Right.
And let the bottom foliage get ugly and just plant something else so you don't see it.
Right.
And then also, you can cut them back hard, like after they flower, or even if they're just in leaf, if they get really nasty, just cut them back to the ground, and they'll flush out new foliage. That'll be cleaner.
Okay. Now, if you do that with the biennial types, you need to leave at least one or two plants, probably to sow some seed for next year, like to be the mother, sort of, for the next generation, or how does that work?
Yeah, you can leave a few. I mean, I'm always advocating home plant breeding, as you know. So if you have the biennials, I always say pick out your favorite ones, the ones that had the most flowers, that had the
okay.
least rust, that looked the prettiest.
Okay.
Let those set seed and then whack everybody else down hard.
Okay.
And if you do cut them back after flowering, the biennials will often come back for a third year. So that's a good way to extend the life.
Okay, so it might be sort of biennial / short-lived perennial kind of.
Especially if you don't let them set seed, they don't spend the energy on seeds, and often they'll come through another year.
Okay. Yeah, back of the border is a good idea, definitely, because, you know, so with something that covers its legs, as you said, definitely a good idea.
And they're so huge. I mean, these things, I saw one, a neighbor's growing them, and they fertilize like crazy, and it's literally 10 feet tall.
The hollyhock that ate the garden, I mean, that's a big plant, 10 feet tall.
It is massive. It's unbelievable. And so if you put that in the front of the border, it's going to block everything else.
Right,
it in the back and let it have a little rust, you know, enjoy it.
Yeah.
Normal plants in the front.
So what about color range and flower forms and heights? And, you know, you just talked about your neighbor who feeds them a lot and they're 10 feet tall, and you were mentioning 6 feet in other cases. The different species, are they different sizes and colors available? Or
so the color range, you can go from all the way to black. There's some really clearly black ones or nearly black flowers, through reds and purples and pinks and pale yellows, not a lot of really strong yellows.
Mm.
There's double flowered forms that I think are kind of, I don't like them. They're too busy for me. But if you do like them, big powder puff flowers.
Right.
And there's also a new series called the Halo series, which
yes.
is really pretty.
Yes.
It's beautiful. It has this dark, like a dark eye in the center of the flower. They're gorgeous.
Yeah.
They've also been the most rust. I mean, they get so much rust in my garden anyway.
Oh.
They've been a little shy on the disease thing, but it's one of the things, the flowers are really spectacular and an interesting new pattern for those.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I read about those, and I, you know, a couple of places that I did see a decent selection of, because a lot, what I recall is that years ago when I would get the seed, it would always be like a mixed color thing, you know? It was mm-hmm. like I couldn't just get the pale yellow or it was unusual to be able to just pick one color. But I'm seeing that places like, and I think they have plants and seeds in some of these places, like Select Seeds catalog. She has, you know, single color strains, you know, where you can just get the one thing as opposed to a mix. She has a mix too. And I think Annie's Annuals out in California, I think they have a lot of those halo ones, actually. I think that's where I saw the sort of full range
yeah.
of that. And they were very beautiful. And it may be that they get less rust in certain environments. Like, they have a very different environment there than we have.
Definitely, the less, if you have less summer humidity,
yeah.
the rust is less of a problem.
Yeah, yeah. So that would make sense. Yeah.
It really depends on where you are, how much of a problem it's going to be. Another place to go look is Gelido seeds.
Gelido, right. Right.
They're in Germany, and they actually have done a bunch of breeding. So they have a new line of perennial forms. And they have a really nice one called Black Knight, which is that black flower, which has been only in the Rosea, which is pretty rust in the biennial. But Black Knight's a really nice perennial that's been disease-resistant, has that really cool, you know, nearly black flowers on it.
Right. I might have seen that. That might have been at Annie's. I can't remember.
I think Annie's is carrying it.
Yeah.
If you want plants, order them from Annie's. She'll ship them as plants.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can get seeds from Gelido or somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. So, Select Seeds has the Nigra one, the other, you know, black one. But at any rate, yeah, so they are available, and there are now some ways to get the single color if you don't want the sort of riot of color thing that is the old-fashioned cottage garden-y look. So heights, you know, from like what, 4 feet up, or what are they?
Yeah, I think 4 feet is about the shortest. And there are
okay.
ones that are annuals that'll flower the first year from seed that are really short, which I don't see the point to, because I can grow lots of 3 foot tall perennials or annuals. But most of the perennials, it really depends on how much you feed them and water them. Especially, you know, if the biennial is during that first season,
right.
saving up the energy to grow. So I'm kind of a lazy gardener, and they fend and as they will, and I don't fertilize much or irrigate, and the deer eat them down occasionally, and most of mine come out around 5-6 feet. If you
okay.
really give them rich soil, regular irrigation, you can push them to 8-10 feet. And when
wow.
they get really huge, you're probably going to have to stake them because they'll get top heavy. But
wow.
you can really make a really dramatic, fun statement with them, just if you pamper them a little bit.
I guess that's why people planted them near their fence, because they could always tie them to the fence or
yeah,
something,
that would
right?
Yeah, that would work well. I'm terrible about staking.
Me too.
The other reason, I don't pamper them too much, because I know they're just going to smash in the mud if I don't.
Right.
If I grow them too tall.
Right, right. So, okay, so hollyhocks, so we got to get us some, and but petunias, I laughed so much because I think you might be the only other nut I know who, like, reads these stories about things like this. I got so excited. This was around mid-May, and I think I first read it in, like, Garden Center magazine, one of the trade publications, or at least on their website and their e-newsletter or something. And I think the first headline was like breaking, as in breaking news, you know, breaking.
Yes.
Finnish, like from Finland, Finnish report prompts petunia genetics investigation in the U.S. And then a few days later, there was the follow-up story, and the headline was unauthorized GE petunias, as in genetically engineered, unauthorized GE petunias, USDA and industry weigh in. So, you know, it's all very, like, grave and serious. And I mean, maybe we shouldn't laugh because it is grave and serious. But let's talk about what happened with petunias that turn out to be genetically engineered. And this is not all petunias, but we'll explain that, right? Let's give us a little backstory.
Yes. So what it seems to be as this story is unfolded.
Unraveling.
Back in the 80s, actually. Academics moved a gene from corn into petunias. And when they moved that gene from corn into petunias, it turned the flowers orange.
Yes.
And they just did it in a lab just to try to figure out, hey, what does this gene do, basically? And then from then it just sort of, you know, there's one paper published on it. And then this guy in Finland was walking down the street and saw these orange petunias and said, hey, when I was in graduate school, I remember seeing petunias that looked like this, and they had a corn gene in them. So he took a sample. I think it was from in front of the train station or something in Helsinki, and took them back to his lab and ran a test. And was like, yep, they have that corn gene. And that gene never got approval. They were never, you know, went through the regulatory processes that we have for genetically modified organisms. And so now Europe and the U.S. is ordering all of them to be destroyed because they are classified as a biohazard, technically.
Right. So it's very interesting. First of all, for me, the funniest part was, until I saw this story, you know, there's only been really one petunia that I've ever really fallen for in a big way. And this was, I don't know how many years ago. It was in the last 10 years, but it wasn't in the last 3 or 4 years. It was a little somewhere between, like, maybe it was 5, 6 years ago. I don't know. Anyway. I haven't really seen it since, but it caught my eye because I'm an orange person, and it was called papaya, and it was in the potunia, like pottunia, P-O-T-U-N-I-A line from a particular breeding company, and it was so distinctive. It really was like a papaya-ish, like the inside of a papaya kind of color, and I just loved it, and I grew it for a year or two, and then it just kind of disappeared. And I wondered why it was orange. Well, I didn't know it had corn genes. You know what I mean? And sure enough, it's on the list of all the naughty petunias. And so this is really a regulation breaking issue, not a safety issue, because this isn't a food crop. So it's not like, oh, it's a food or a fodder crop that we're either eating ourselves or feeding to animals. But they broke a rule by doing this and not, like, filing that they were doing this, right? It's a regulatory issue.
Yeah, and I think most people would say that, one, we're not eating it, and then also the orange pigment, it's not like, you know, we put in corn, they put these insecticidal genes, that's an insecticide.
Right.
And that might have impacts on the environment, but an orange pigment in a flower seems to have little, you know, safety concerns or larger ecological.
Right.
In Europe, it would probably be very difficult to get deregulated. In the U.S., it would probably be pretty, you know, our rules are a little more laxer on that.
Right.
So, yeah, they probably could have gone through the proper channels and got this released legally. What's interesting is that it sort of, the trait popped up in, like, 4 different companies breeding all about the same time, and they're all just saying, God, we have no idea where it came from. which you have to wonder, like, you see this crazy new color, and everyone's like, well, I don't know, it just sort of arrived.
Right.
So, be interesting to find out, everyone's just saying, God, we have no idea how it happened, we're destroying them all. It'd be interesting to know exactly how the gene moved from some university research program into all these different petunia breeding programs around the world, actually.
To do the forensics. Maybe it could be the next season of Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch, right? They can investigate
right.
it, right? And one thing the USDA, by the way, a spokesperson for the USDA said in one of the more recent stories is that, you know, again, because it's not a risk to human health because we don't eat them, they're not asking consumers who might have an orange petunia in their garden or retailers that have them in stock that have invested in them to destroy them this season. They're just saying, hey, breeders, growers, retailers, voluntarily withdraw them from distribution, destroy them. You know what I mean? It's not like you, the gardener, is breaking some law or has something dangerous. So again, not a safety. It's a compliance issue, not a safety thing. But when I read, I think it was like only a week or two like 2 weeks ago, the latest story that I had read or scanned, at least. I mean, it was like I couldn't even understand. You know, I was like, okay, a spokesman for the USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Biotechnology Regulatory Services says that the exact genetic identification has not been confirmed. They're still testing, in other words, right, to figure out not just the corn thing, but what else is going on in there. Because they're not all exactly the same, and there's a whole list of varieties, as you say, from multiple breeders. And they're looking at, you know, we are advising organizations to test for the presence of cauliflower mosaic virus 35S RNA promoter. You know, I mean, it was like in language that's not even in English, and I'm like, what? What does this all mean? What?
What that means is, weirdly, in the U.S., we don't, for non-food crops, we don't actually regulate genetic engineering per se.
Right.
So if it's just the corn gene, actually, you could insert a corn gene into petunias and release it with no approval, and that would be perfectly legal in the U.S. You couldn't do that in Europe. But what they usually do is a combination of the corn gene and then this cauliflower mosaic virus gene that you just mentioned, and that virus gene is regulated.
Right.
So if they have the corn gene but not the virus, it might be okay, but if they have the viral gene plus the corn gene, then it definitely is not.
Oy vey, Shirley, I'm telling you, my head is spinning over here.
Yeah.
But this is the crazy intrigue.
What I think is interesting is, because like I just said, they could recreate this if they just avoided using the viral DNA
right.
and just used the corn DNA.
Right.
You could recreate it legally in the U.S. I bet a lot of companies are watching the reaction to this, because there really hasn't been a lot of public outcry
right.
that I've noticed anyway.
Right.
And they'd be saying, well, maybe we'll just wait a couple years and then we'll do this, make essentially the same thing, but just tweak it a bit to avoid the regulation and release it. It'll be interesting to see whether this kind of opens up
right.
a brave new world
right.
in petunia breeding.
Right. It's a little bit of test case, or another breeding for that matter. They'll use it as a standard. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Joseph Tokanovich, I'm always interested. I love the fact that I finally found somebody who's interested in as kooky, strange things as I am. We're separated at birth. And I wish you the super best with the move. I know that's stressful, but I think it's so exciting. And we're going to be welcoming you to the East Coast, though slightly to the south of me. So I will talk to you soon again, I hope.
All right. I would love that.
Okay. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.